Number one, this administration set in motion the greatest steal on the American people since the administrations of Harding and Coolidge and Hoover. It set in motion hard money, high interest, and tight credit, which is at best only a special privilege to a handful of people and a burden upon the multitude. Number two, it proceeded in the 83rd Republican Congress to what it said was rewrite the tax laws. They had a better word for it. They called it recodification. Well, the only thing related to cod was the way it smelled. Recodification. And what was the result of it? Listen, my friends, let me tell you the result. The result has been that the tax laws of this country are filled with tax loopholes, inequities. Not a single working man or woman in this audience received as much as any benefits. And yet those who are the recipients of dividend income, gas and oil income, mineral income, receive huge depletion allowances and benefits at the expense of the majority of the taxpayers. Yes, billions of dollars of lost income, my friends, that could have been used for schools, could have been used for national defense, could have been used for effective foreign economic policy, could have been used to build better communities in America. Billions of it, my friends, lost in the name of a tax law. The Republicans don't forget their friends. They're good to them. The trouble is, you're not one of them, and you better remember it. They took care of their friends. Well, I remember when that fellow Benson came to Minnesota. They thought they could send him out there because of his name. We have a number of Scandinavian free people in our state. He came out there to remind farmers they were going to take less. The administration reminded workers that they had to stop seeking wage increases. The administration reminded bankers they ought to take more. And the administration said to some special groups in economic life and some of the financial interests, we're going to fix the tax laws for you. And it's all been so complicated. It's all been so cleverly done. It's all been so cleverly camouflaged in the name of sound finance, anti-inflation, good business, that we have literally been as a nation brainwashed as to what has happened. But these crows come home to roost. Unbalanced budgets, the inadequacy of our community developments, inadequate funds for a host of activities that were needed. But let me tell you the third one that was the crowning glory, so to speak, of them all for this administration. What was the secret of the New Deal? Why was it that certain interests really hated Mr. Roosevelt? Because of the regulatory commissions. The commissions that he established to protect the public interests. The great bodies of public authority that were established to protect your interest and my interest. And every great president has done just this. And this administration proceeded not to dismiss these commissions, not to repeal New Deal laws, but proceeded, my friends, to take the soul and the spirit out of them, to take away from them effective administration, and to change the personnel, the people administering these bodies, so that the law was there, the body, but the spirit was gone. What happened? Well, I remember they appointed a new housing administrator. They appointed a man that had been defeated for Congress. His record in Congress was that he had opposed every housing bill since he'd been in Congress. So the administration said to you, we're for housing, and then proceeded to hire the number one arch enemy the well-tested, thoroughly experienced number one enemy of housing and put him in charge of the housing authority. I responded at that time, it was like putting a fox in charge of the chicken coop, and I was right. Or maybe I can give you, since you're not farm people, maybe I should give you a better example. It's like putting a scab in charge of the picket line. And by the way, if any of you don't believe it, just ask our good friends, the Kohler workers, who have been waiting for the NLRB to give them a decision for months, years. But when you have boards and agencies that are not dedicated to the public interest, you're not going to get decisions to protect the public interest. This is true of Securities Exchange, of Federal Power, of Federal Trade Commission. I shan't number them all. All I'll say is that from the very beginning, the pattern of things to come was designed. The hard money, high interest policy, which takes its toll from every consumer and every taxpayer and slows down this economy, was designed, sealed, and delivered in the month of March, 1953. The inequitable tax structure, which today is sealed upon our backs, was designed, passed, and delivered in the summer of 1954. The regulatory commissions have been weakened, their purposes diluted ever since January 1953. This is the price that we've paid for half-time, part-time, inadequate government. Now let me take you very seriously now to what I think are the three great challenges before us. Those challenges, you know, they're outlined right here in your own body of resolutions, for which I want to commend this organization and this splendid convention. What are the three challenges before the nation? The three challenges before any political party, and particularly the one that I am privileged to represent this morning. Number one, the first challenge is to fulfill our true and wholehearted economic potential. Number two, to achieve full dignity, freedom, and justice for every American. And number three, to win a just and an enduring peace. These are the three great challenges before America and its political leadership in the months to come. Now, number one, you can't fulfill your economic potential if you have a government that is wedded to economic and monetary policies that act like a brake on the economy. Not only have they been a brake, but as one magazine said, it's one thing to put on the brakes, but it's another thing to throw us through the windshield. America's economy has lagged. It has been designed this way by the economic architects of this administration. You can't have the realization of your full economic potential when you have in Washington an administration that is symbolized by these words: no go, go slow, not now, veto, injunction, administration. It can't be done. You can't realize our full economic potential when people are being conditioned by public leaders to accept 3.5 million to 4 million unemployed as a normal cushion in the workforce. An administration that shows so little concern about the waste of manpower, the waste of talent and skill, as this administration, is indeed a no-go, go-slow administration. And you can't have full employment by just indulging in scare words, trying to frighten the American people from their mission of the fulfillment of our economic potential. I do not have the time this morning to tell you the toll that this administration has taken from this economy. 10 million man years of lost work, billions of dollars of lost production, billions of dollars of lost public revenues. Why? Because it seems to be more afraid of so-called inflation, which it generates by its own policies, than it is courageous and fearless in meeting the challenge of economic competition from the Soviet Union and from other nations abroad. You know what this challenge is. You know that an America that grows at the rate of 2.5% a year is not an America that is up to the task for the coming years of facing up to our international responsibilities. You know that an America that grows at this snail's pace cannot provide the jobs that our families need. And you know full well that a government that doesn't support and doesn't get behind effective legislation to bring America up to its full capacity is a government that fails us in an hour of crisis. What do we need? Housing? Yes. Minimum wage legislation? I should say so. And not just minimum wage legislation, but a minimum of $1.25 an hour expanded coverage into the uncovered areas of American economic life. But regrettably, this administration says no. No, $1.25 an hour is too much for a worker. But 5% interest on short-term bonds is just a beginning. Just a beginning. The same administration, my friends, that says we're too hard up to have a program for the depressed areas of America is the same administration that walks back into Congress and says we need another $500 million to pay the increased interest upon a segment of the public debt. It appeals for this, and it demeans the other. Now, I said the second objective must be achieve full dignity, freedom, and justice for every American, and I mean just that. The best thing that we can do in America today to really project our strength in this world, the greatest thing that we could do for freedom and peace, is to set an example of social and economic and political conduct that would be the envy of the world. The way we treat each other is more impressive, my friends, than the words we say to others. The way we treat our own minorities, the way we regard our own people, is the real test of American leadership and American morals. And when I say to you, when I say that we need to achieve full dignity, freedom and justice for every American, I have some specifics in mind. Let me say this to you. You can just about tell the kind of a government you have and what its philosophy is by the way that it treats three groups in our society. The young, the children who are in the dawn of life. The elderly, who are in the shadows of life or the twilight of life. And the handicapped, the disabled and the sick, who are in the storm clouds of life. And I say to this audience this morning that this administration is guilty of callous neglect of all three. It talks of education, even with the scare of a Sputnik and a Lunik, and it does nothing. It refuses to balance the moral budget as it worships the fiscal budget. Federal aid to schools, the administration says we can't afford it. When every mother and father and every citizen in this nation knows that the lack of proper education in America is one of our weaknesses, it may be the Achilles heel in the struggle to come. America needs to mobilize its brain power as well as to increase its firepower. And federal aid to education is a must. And any man that stands up and says he's for national security, that he wishes to wage this competitive coexistence, he better stand up and volunteer now, unequivocally, for federal aid to schools, for federal aid to education, so that America can lead the world in this great experiment of education for humanity. And what about our elderly people? What about our elderly? The same administration that says you can't expect to get bonds sold unless you raise interest is the same administration that says to every grandmother and grandfather in America, you'll have to wait. 1,200,000 widows in this country under Social Security getting less than $56 a month. And this administration has the unmitigated gall to think that's adequate, or that an increase is inflationary. More and more of our people growing old, and less of attention by government to the problems that come therein. Yes, I believe in, and I stand for, and I advocate an increase in Social Security and an expansion of its coverage. And I include in that, my friends, I include within that hospital and medical care for our people who are the recipients of old age and survivors insurance under Social Security. President Ruther, I want to congratulate you and your great union on the fine medical program that you are inaugurating, which I've read about, which has made the headlines, and justly so. What a great thing for the members of the United Automobile Workers. Well done. Would that our government would follow your humanitarian example. And by the way, if we keep them well, what about having some housing that's worthy of humankind too? Housing for our elderly, and hospitals and medical research across the land for our people. And now then, that other area of human dignity, and quickly. I've been told that when I emphasize civil rights, that I prejudice my chances in politics. I've been told that my advocacy of civil rights has become a roadblock in politics. Well, let me just say this, that if the price of political success in America is to betray what are my convictions, is to betray and to hush up what I believe to be right, just, and moral, then I guess I'll pay the price, because I shall not change. It is on civil rights, which is nothing more or less than citizenship rights. That's all. That's just another word for it. It's on civil rights, constitutional rights, American rights, natural rights, God-given rights, that we either nobly win or meanly lose. The moral and spiritual battle that is being waged in this world today. I hope that every person in this hall will heed my words. Even if the so-called subject of civil rights was not morally and politically right, and it is, even if one didn't want to justify this on the basis of ethics and morality, I remind this audience that the population centers of the world that represent power, represent victory, represent survival for us, that those population centers are people of so-called color. There are more colored than Caucasian, more colored than white, and I say to the minority that is gathered here today, wake up before it's too late. Share our civilization and what it means to us with others before we lose it. There is no issue more important before the American people today than this issue of our human rights. I repeat again, I for one believe that it is time. It's long overdue. We're already generations late for America to walk out of the shadows of states' rights and into the bright sunshine of human rights, and everybody here knows it. Now, what are some of the specifics? Because words must be backed up by details. Number one, it is time for the Congress to wholeheartedly embrace and support by affirmative action and resolution the desegregation decisions of the United States Supreme Court. Number two, it is time for the Congress to enact what we failed to enact in 1957 through threat of filibuster. What we failed to enact in 1958, namely Part 3 of the so-called Civil Rights Program. Part 3 meaning what? Empowering the Attorney General of the United States to protect the legitimate constitutional rights of every American by being able to bring suit into a federal court to protect those rights, those voting rights, those citizenship rights, those educational rights of every man, woman, and child in this nation. I wonder about us. The same Congress that will pass a selective service law which will compel men of all races, creeds, and colors to live together, to train together, to be educated together, and if need be, die together. The very same Congress that will impose upon citizens their supreme duty is unwilling, so far, to say to the nation that if these men and women can fight together and die together, then they can live together, be educated together, work together, and they can vote together to make American democracy work. Yes, and I do. And I do support federal registration as recommended by the Civil Rights Commission. It is interesting to know that the Civil Rights Commission's recommendations had not, in most instances, unanimous approval. And in the instance of federal registration of voters, my friends, had 5 of the 6 members supporting this recommendation. Now, of conclusion, the final of our great challenges. And I believe this is the greatest of them all. The winning of a just and an enduring peace. Peace is not passive. Peace is active. Peace is not appeasement. Peace is strength. And I want to express my personal, private, and public thanks to this convention and this great international union for the foresight and the courage and the wisdom that it has exemplified in its resolutions on the subject of American foreign policy. Oh, how well I recall the words of some people of recent date. Only recently, a critic of this union had something to say about your international president and Mr. Khrushchev. I quote him. He said, "It is nice of Mr. Khrushchev to come over, but from the cool reception he has received so far, it looks as if the only sympathetic audience he will be given, that he will have, will be in San Francisco with Ruther and Kerry." Now, that was an old buddy of yours talking, Buddy Barry Goldwater. But you see, the trouble is, the conservatives just don't understand what this is all about, and we ought not to be too critical. They don't understand what's going on in this world, and I mean it. The tragedy of our times is that the official policies of this conservative administration have never been able to identify America throughout the world with peace, people, and progress. It has become impossible, literally, for a conservative government to understand people and the social forces that are at work in this world. They can't understand this revolution of rising expectations in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. The conservatives understand things, not people. They never were able to identify themselves with the hopes and aspirations of people, even here in America. They never had that soul-like insight of a Franklin Roosevelt, who, even though crippled and forced literally to stay in a chair, was able to call upon America to walk forward, to proceed forward with a strong and an active faith. It was Roosevelt who understood our rendezvous with destiny. It was Roosevelt and Truman who was able to identify America with the hungry, with the needy, with the destitute and the sick. There can be no doubt about it that the number one problem is the securing of a just and an enduring peace. And I remind you that it is not easy. And it is going to require an understanding of the world in which we live. It is going to require a liberal program at home so that we have a sensible foreign policy abroad. You cannot treat Americans one way and expect that people abroad will think they're going to be treated another way. So I lay down to you what I think are certain effective measures to be taken. First of all, high on the agenda should be, with American initiative, the seeking of a responsible program of disarmament under international inspection. Yes, so that we can convert our tools into the instruments of peace, so that we can release the energies of mankind into constructive works. But I remind this audience that until we can get such a program, until we can have a meeting of the minds in this world where we can be sure that in our pursuit of disarmament with inspection and controls, that we will not lay ourselves open to attack. The following must be done. One, a military capability that is strong enough and effective enough to deter aggression wherever it may be. Two, a steadily developing and expanding economy with full employment at home, with the maximum utilization of our resources, so that we can endure for a long period of time the responsibilities of world leadership. Third, a broad and long-ranged economic policy overseas that will build new markets, that will help people to help themselves, and that will give people an opportunity to build institutions of freedom and democracy. And fourth, intelligent, determined, and dedicated efforts to reach agreements, in negotiations, such as an agreement to stop this senseless testing of thermonuclear weapons with adequate controls and inspection to save mankind from a thermonuclear holocaust. I do not give you easy assignments. I say to this audience that we have everything to win this struggle with except one. America has the resources. America has the capital. America has the skilled workers. America has everything with which we can win this Cold War save one. Leadership, purpose, dedication, and a call to action to the American people. This is what is needed. And I have a feeling that this audience, representing hundreds of thousands of workers, senses with me some of the things that we might do. Instead of crying about this God-given abundance of food and fiber, my friends, in a world where half of humanity is hungry, let's translate food and fiber surpluses into food and fiber power for peace and for people and for progress throughout the world, and it can be done. Food for peace. Food for peace and freedom. Imagine what old Khrushchev would be doing if he had enough wheat today for 60 billion loaves of bread. We have. And the biblical stories of the loaves and the fishes can be applied today. Throughout all of this world, there are people yearning for one good meal as America wallows in its so-called surpluses. I tell you, my friends, there can be no peace in a world of the hungry. There can be no peace in a world of the sick. And there are more people this morning that are sick than are well. There are more people throughout the world that are in need of medical care than have it. And here is America, blessed with the greatest medical science that the world has ever known. Let us demonstrate what we mean by our kind of democracy, by mobilizing the health resources, the medical research, by expanding our programs of medical care, not only here, but abroad, in conjunction and cooperation with others. A mighty attack upon man's ancient enemy of disease. You see, what the world needs is not massive retaliation. What the world needs, my friends, is massive rehabilitation. Massive doses of science and education. Massive doses of health and food. Massive doses of understanding and loving care. And I say to this audience that in a world of the hungry, the sick, and the illiterate, Communism finds ready allies. It provides a fertile seedbed for that noxious weed of totalitarianism. So the attack for peace must not merely be in creating weapons of defense, important as that shield of defense may be. But as I said, peace is not passive, peace is active. And I call upon the great unions of the United States and of the free world to state for once and for all that we're prepared to launch a mighty war against poverty wherever it may be, against disease and destitution, and that we're prepared to do our level best to give to mankind enlightenment, to obliterate from the face of this earth illiteracy, and that we're prepared to be our brother's keeper and to share with those who are less fortunate the principles of American free trade unionism, the principles of the American labor movement. Embrace everything I've spoken of. You believe in helping those who are in trouble. You believe in solidarity of the forces of freedom. You believe in production for use. You believe in education, in health. You believe in care of those who cannot care for themselves. And I ask this great and wonderful organization, under the inspiring leadership of its president and its officers, I ask you to do even more than you've done, to make your voice ring out as the soldiers of peace, unafraid, willing to lead this world and indeed this America in a path that is worthy of our heritage, the path of freedom and plenty, the path of health and opportunity, the path of education and social justice. You can do no less. And I too enlist in this struggle and stand shoulder to shoulder with you. Let us move ahead. Thank you very much.